Okay, let's go ahead and get started, everyone. Can you hear me okay? I always have trouble getting the volume on this. Too loud? Okay, so I hope everyone's enjoying this beautiful weather. Seems like a long time ago that we had our last class back on Thursday, but as you might recall, we covered pointers and some of the tricky issues with pointer arithmetic and converting to and from a pointer. We talked about libraries and we talked about makefiles. So I'll just briefly mention a couple of things as review from Thursday, and then we'll move ahead and we'll be covering more about makefiles, and we'll start talking about accounts and permissions. So we were looking at this example in the last class where we have a couple of .o files that are based on some CN header files, and also can load a library, and we talked about building a library. We talked a little bit about static versus dynamic libraries. So a static library, the actual code in that library, which might consist of multiple .o files that have been bundled together, that static library is actually placed in the executable. So the executable, if it has only static libraries, or maybe a better way to put it is the executable, if it doesn't use any shared libraries, is a completely standalone object. Now, note that if the library is not in one of the standard system locations, so if it's a library that you've created, for example, you're going to need to specify the path where the compiler will find that library when it's building the executable. And you only need to worry about the path to find the static library when you build the executable, not when you run it, because that library is in the executable. There's no extra thing to load when you run the application. Shared libraries are a different story. They have a different ending. You create them a different way. And in addition to specifying a path for where to find the library when you build the application, you also need to tell the compiler how to find that shared library when the application runs. And so here, for example, we see an example where we couldn't load the library because we didn't know where to look for it. So the advantage of shared libraries is that the same application can benefit from updates to these shared libraries just for free. The disadvantage is that if the interfaces are changed, then you'll have a compatibility issue, and that could just happen at runtime. That should generally not be happening. And you have to worry about where to find libraries. Where to find libraries when the application runs. And this is not an issue for standard system libraries. There's a standard path where the compiler will know where, will set the application to know where to look. But if you're building your own shared library, then you need to set that path. And there are a few different ways that you can do this that we covered in the last class. And I won't spend more time on this because I want to make sure we get to some other material, but you can go back and review the material from the last lecture on this. So when you're linking against libraries, you generally want to put the libraries at the end. And remember this notation here, dash L name, means that you're linking to lib name.a or and the reason that you put the library at the end is that the linker processes files in order, and it only grabs things from the library that it thinks it's going to need. So you put the link, the library at the end, so that by then the compiler knows all of the different functions that it's going to need to pull from this library. So we looked at this example, and we talked about what needs to run if main.c changes or if extra.h changes. And the key here is that main.c and extra.c both include these .h files, in particular this .h file. So if main.c changes, we only need to run command 1. But if extra.h changes, then we need to run all three of these commands, because both extra.c and main.c depend on extra.h. And then we started talking about make rules. And the format of these make rules is that this thing is a target. These are the prerequisites or dependencies. And this here is the rule that gets run if the dependencies are newer than the target, or if the target doesn't exist. And this here has to be a true tab character. So that was all review. Any questions so far? Okay. Oh, by the way, before I forget, so my typical office hours are at 3:30, Tuesday, Thursday. Just so you know, this Thursday, I won't make it to my office hours. I have another obligation. So there are plenty of other office hours that we have scheduled, and we're releasing the office hour schedule. But just want to make sure people know not to come to my door and then wonder why I'm not there on Thursday. All right, so then we talked about chains of rules. So you'll see here that program depends on these.o files, and each of these has a rule. So when you process that first dependency statement, this line here, you're going to check main.o and extra.o, and they have their own rules and their own dependencies here. So for example, if extra.h has been updated, that should trigger both the extra.o and the main.o rules and the compilation of those corresponding files, so that we can then update program. So this is a really useful way when you're building a complicated project, or even just a project with a few different files, to make sure that when you change one thing, everything that depends on it will get recompiled without needing to build the entire application every single time. So by default, make is going to run the first target in the make file. But you can specify which targets you want it to run by saying make and then the name of one or more of these targets here. So, for example, if you say make target, that will cause make to look in the make file for the rule that builds target. And then the whole chain of rules that are associated with that will get processed. And if you say make target 1 and target 2, it will do this for both of those targets. Any questions so far? All right. So we left off, I hinted that we'd look at this exercise. So, talk to your neighbors and figure out which answer here at the bottom is correct. Which of these commands is going to run based on these modification times? And this will give you a feeling for whether you understand how targets and dependencies work. So talk to your neighbor, and then we'll vote in a minute. Okay, so let's go ahead and vote. Everybody ready? All right, so how many people think that when I say make W, nothing will run? Everything's already up to date. Any votes for A? Okay, how about B? How many think that build Y will be the only command that runs? Okay, how about C? Build W, then build Y. D, build Y, then build W. Okay, how about E? All three rules. All right, and anybody for F? A few for F. And then G, something else. All right, so the answer here is E. So the majority of you recognize that, but this is a tricky example, so let's walk through it. So this dependency graph helps illustrate what depends on what and their modification times. So recall here, the W depends on X and Y. So we see that here because W has arrows to X and Y and so on and so forth. So to make W, we need X and Y to be up to date. And that means we have to go check X and then check Y. So to make X up to date, we need Q to be up to date. And there's no rule for Q. And then we build X if it is less recent than Q. So Q is 2 hours old, but X is 3 hours old. So Q has been updated more recently, so that means X needs to be rebuilt to get it up to date with the changes in Q. So we need to do build X. So we do it in this order here. So we start with X. We saw that Q here is newer, so we have to run build X. Now we're going to look at Y, which depends on X and Z. So we see that y depends on x and z. Well, y doesn't even exist, so of course we're going to have to build it. And we also need x and z to be up to date, but they're leaf nodes in our diagram, right? They're dependencies that don't have associated rules. So we just need to make sure that they exist. And so we're going to build y, and now w depends on x and x and y are clearly newer than w, so we have to build w. I forgot that we had these examples here to go through, but so any questions on why we have to do all three of these? Yes. Sorry, I didn't quite, that was too many steps for me to capture in my mental cache here. So just say it again.
Okay, so right now, it's only checking if x is less recent than q.
Right.
So if, let's say, you update q and you also update x, but like after you, if you update x after you update q, would it not, would it build Q as well, or would it just build X, or?
So if X is newer than Q,
yeah.
And let's go back here to the makefile to see the makefile version of this. If X is newer than Q, then X will not get rebuilt.
X won't get rebuilt. Okay, so would you have to like make a separate thing for that, or?
So you're saying
if X is newer than Q, but W still depends on X, then you need to rebuild X. But if X is newer than Q right now, you can't rebuild X because it's newer than Q.
But I'm not quite following why you would need to rebuild X if X is newer than Q. So all the dependencies that X requires to be up to date have to be specified as dependencies after the colon. So if there's anything that can change that would make you need to rebuild X, it needs to be listed as a dependency after the colon. And
don't you need to build X itself if X, like if X itself?
So I think we're, so here, for example, X might be a library that depends on some .o files. And you wouldn't directly modify the library. It depends on some constituents. So it took me a sec, but I realized that that's what you were getting at.
.o
or .a or something like that. And we'll see some more concrete examples in a minute that I think will clarify that. And then you had a question?
Yeah. I was just going to ask if W was modified like 4 hours ago, would it just be none?
If W was modified 4 hours ago, it would still have to be rebuilt because it's older than X and Y. After we, so W is going to check X and X and Y are getting rebuilt. So now they're newer, the dependencies are newer than W, so W now needs to get rebuilt. Yes. Correct. So it doesn't matter how old, in this particular case, Y's dependencies are. You mentioned the example of Z, because Z is, because Y just doesn't exist, so you have to build it. So when you check the dependencies in the makefile here, when you check the dependencies, first of all, if y doesn't exist, we're going to go ahead and build it. So any other questions? Okay. So often in a make file, we want other helper functions. Like, for example, the ability to make a set of targets, and we might call that target all. So all would specify a set of things that need to be, a set of rules that need to be checked. So for example, we might want to make sure that program one and program two and this library get built. So if all specifies all of those, then make all is effectively a shorthand for running the rules for all three of these targets and checking their dependencies and making sure they're up to date. There's no actual file associated with all, which means this rule will get triggered every single time, no matter what, which is what we want. Now, if program one and program two in libfoo.a exist, and they're newer than all of their dependencies, then nothing happens other than checking that that's the case. Another example of a phony target is something like cleaning up intermediate files. So let's say we want to be tidy, and after we've built our application, we want to get rid of the .o files because we don't need them anymore. We can specify a rule called clean that, when we say make clean, will remove all of those .o files. Again, there's no file called clean that we're building. So every time we say make clean, this rule is going to happen. Now, there is a little catch to this. If, in these examples, there's an actual file in the directory called all or called clean, then because there are no dependencies here, these rules won't run. It will say, let's say you say make clean, and it finds that there's a file called clean. There's nothing that needs to be done. The file exists. It doesn't depend on anything. There's no out-of-date question to worry about. So there's actually a feature in make that lets you specify that certain targets are phony and you should ignore any files that are in the directory that might interfere with running these commands. And there's a few standard targets that we use for this. All will be a set of things that should all build together. Clean, maybe there's a test target. And we can specify these as phony and make sure that when the user says make all or make clean, that the right things happen. And if somebody accidentally, maybe through a typo on a command line, created a file unintentionally with that name, that it won't interfere with the correct operation of the make file. So what that phony is saying, this is a line that you put in your make file, what that phony is saying is ignore any files in the directory that have these names. Go ahead and treat these as rules that should be run. And so here are some conventional target names. So remember, the first rule in the make file will get run by default. Or you can say all. That's a phony target that will let you specify a group of things to build. Remember also that when you say make, you can say make and any target of your choice, like make clean is actually an example of this, and that is the only target that will run. But these are some standard targets, phony targets that you might use. Yes?
So do you have to hard code clean into your make file, or does it come like pre-applied?
No, you have to actually write this make file code. Because what gets cleaned up will be specific to your project. Any questions so far before I go on to this? Okay, so you'll notice here in a make file like this that there's some redundancy. First of all, we're using the same compiler each time. Second, we're using the same options each time. And if I want to change the compiler, like let's say change Clang to GCC, or if I want to change the options, so instead of dash W all, I want to use some other options, it's tedious to go through every rule and change them. Now, yeah, you could do a global search and replace, but personally, I'm always a little scared of doing global search and replace because maybe something will get changed that I didn't anticipate. So I tend to be pretty judicious in using that and instead go through each one. So find and replace where I sort of click accept on every one, and that gets tedious. And there's a simple way around this. I can write variables, which are actually called macros in make terminology, that embed these things that I might want to change on a global level, like the choice of compiler, or the choice of flags that I give to the compiler or the linker, or maybe the libraries that are going to get linked with all of my applications. And so now you see here that we can specify a rule here. There's no dollar sign or anything. We just have some text. Doesn't have to be capitalized, but by convention it is. And an equal sign. And then whatever comes after it is what will be associated with that macro. And it will get expanded whenever it's used like this. And so in this example now, what happens is dollar sign parentheses CC gets converted into whatever value was assigned, which in this case is GCC. And LD flags gets expanded into all of those flags. And if I want to make a change that's globally effective, I just have to change the macros at the top. And boom, everything is affected. So it's handy. Pretty straightforward, but pretty handy and good to know about. There are conventional names for these, for some of these macros. So the compiler for a C application is always going to be $CC. C flags will be the flags for compiling the .o, which you see here. And LD flags is what's used when linking .o and .a files into an executable. So any questions so far? All righty. There's another set of variables called automatic variables. And there's actually a few more beyond this that you can use as a shorthand. And so for example, $&ampersand will be the target. So this will get expanded into program. And $caret is all of the dependencies. So that will get expanded. $caret will get expanded into main.o and extra.o. Down here, we see the use of $less than. So this is the first dependency. So we'll take the first dependency here, and it'll get put in that position. So these automatic variables are funky to read. They use symbols, I assume, because they don't want to restrict what text you use for your own variables, for your own macros. But they can be pretty handy in automating, in regularizing some aspects of writing rules, and especially handy in another feature we'll look at in a minute. Question? So if you need a reference, you can Google makefile automatic variables, and you'll see what these are. And because they're totally non-intuitive, you pretty much need to have that list in front of you. But it's just a Google search away. As an aside, there are multiple versions of Make. Most of these features are pretty standardized, except for something called pattern rules, which we're going to look at next, which aren't supported in some older versions of Make. But they're really handy. So it's a super common situation where you want to produce a .o file from a .c file. And you can write a pattern rule using percent signs like this that will take any .o that needs to be checked, and it depends on a .c file, and you can write a rule for it. So when we're running the program rule, we see that we need to look at main.o and extra.o. So we can come down here, and effectively we substitute main.o and main.c. And then we run the rule with the compiler and the C flags. We output the target. So this would become main.o. And we specify dash C, which means we're producing a .o file. That's the flag to produce a .o. And we're going to use all of the dependencies here. And then down here, we can specify what .h files every .o file depends on. So what the make file is going to do here is actually, it's going to, when it sees these .o files as dependencies, first it checks the dependencies. Then it uses this as the build rule for any .o that has a .c as a dependency. Any questions so far? So with the pattern dependencies, those automatic variables become super useful, right? Because you can write this very generic rule here that doesn't depend on any specific file names. Now, there are a few rules that are actually built into Make. So the example I gave is actually not necessary because Make already knows how to build a .o from a .c. So you don't actually need to write that rule I showed you for building a .o. But for anything else that you're going to do repetitively, it can be handy to use pattern rules like that. However, we don't want you to rely on the built-in rules. We want to make sure you know how to write proper makefile rules. So for the lab, where you might be tempted to write a pattern rule, because it fits, don't use a built-in rule. Sorry. Where you might be tempted to use a built-in rule, because you're going to be making .o files from .c files, don't, right? You can write pattern rules if you want. Sorry, you can write pattern rules if you want. But don't use the built-in rules. Actually write the rules. But when you're out in the real world, you can know that this feature exists. So final comment on make files, and then I'll take questions, is it can be sometimes tricky to get the dependencies right. So you can pass an option called -mm, and there are a few other related options. You can look in the man pages. That will actually output the dependencies to help you write the rules correctly. So you can say gcc-mm, whatever your rule is going to be about, and GCC will, based on the headers that are included, will tell you what you need to put in the make rule. There are also some other things that can help you with generating make files. Don't use that in the lab. You can use -mm. There are other build systems besides Make. Make is not the only game in town. So there are things that are kind of similar. There's a list of them here. The only one I have experience with is Scons, and it's absolutely horrendous, but it exists. And there's a tool in my particular field called Gem5 that uses SCANs. Everybody hates it, but it's like too baked in to change at this point. And then there are some tools that will generate inputs to help you with building, make, and files, and so on, like these. So, any questions?
So, with this program, is there any advantage to like actually writing out a make file as opposed to just being like, just compile everything every single time? Or is it mostly there just for bigger programs? That kind of
For smaller programs, even if it's your makefile is basically going to be one line, unless you're just saying compile 1.c into one executable, it's kind of a way to save typing. So if I have foo.c and I'm going to make foo executable, I could just say gcc foo.c and I'm done. Oh, actually, I have to say dash o foo. But I could make that even shorter by just typing make. So one of the advantages for make is it saves you typing. And as soon as you have more than one file and any headers that you might need to depend on other than the system headers, it becomes really useful to have make do the dependency checking for you. Other questions? All right, so in the lab, you're gonna get some experience writing your own make files. Many of you already have that experience. Then in the first assignment, the warm-up assignment, you're going to write a C program that splits strings. And so you'll have to do some fiddling around with arrays where some of the pointer arithmetic and array manipulation we talked about will come in handy. And you're going to write a make file. So when you submit your warm-up assignment, it also needs to have a correct make file, which after the lab will hopefully be a very easy thing for you to do. Okay, so moving on to the next topic, accounts and permissions. Suppose I have a program that needs to open a file and read some data from disk. And I type the line in my program, open. Now, when I run that program, how does the operating system know whether I'm allowed to access this file? Maybe it's my own private file that I don't want anybody else to have access to. So what if somebody else writes a program that tries to access that file? Or you can imagine many other scenarios where you want to make sure that the file is being opened and used only in the way that the file's owner cares about, right? So I might share a file with other people in my research group. I want them to be able to read it but not write it. How do I make sure that when they use it, they can read it but they can't write it while I can actually modify it? So when you access files and many other system services, simple example, shutting down the computer, the operating system is providing these services. And what's happening is that the application is running a function, a special kind of function called a system call. And the system call invokes the operating system and does the work, but also does the permission checking. So a system call looks to the programmer like a function. And so the OS provides an API for supported system calls. So you can look at what the API is. You can list all the system calls that are supported by an operating system. You can look at the details of what the syntax and semantics are by looking at the man page. What's actually happening, however, is that when that application is compiled, that function, through a sequence of a few steps that we'll talk about later, executes a special assembly instruction and many systems, it's called syscall. And that traps I don't want to get too far ahead of when we discuss this in more depth. That assembly language instruction switches the CPU into a special privileged mode that runs the operating system and then invokes a function inside the operating system that's called a handler for that system call. And so what the compiler does is it sets up your system call as an instruction that takes several arguments. One of them is the system call number, so you know which handler to invoke. And then the arguments you're actually trying to provide, like the file name and any permission modes. So this operating system handler is going to decide if the open call is allowed to proceed. And we'll talk about how it does that. A feature of this way of invoking operating system services is that it ensures that only supported system calls are allowed to be executed. You can't execute a fake system call. There's no way to do that. You can't execute a system call with inappropriate semantics if the system call is written properly, because it checks the arguments. And so we are relying on the operating system to ensure safe implementation and check permissions, check that the arguments are valid, and so on and so forth, and avoid potential vulnerabilities like buffer overflows as well. And so some of these things, like unexpected arguments and unexpected buffer overflows, have been the source of many bugs in operating systems over the years. So how does the OS decide whether the system call should proceed? So it needs some extra data about the process that's calling the system call. So just as a thought exercise, why aren't the system call arguments enough? Well, we need to know something about the user and what that particular user running that application is allowed to do. So for example, and go back to this file that I want to share with a group of other people where I can read and write it, the other users can only read it, right? I need to know what user is accessing that file. And so that means that it's not sufficient just to look at the system call arguments, and it's not sufficient to have the user ID be something that I put in the arguments, because of course the calling program could just lie. And it's not enough to look at something like the name of the process. So I need to actually know the user ID that is running the process that's requesting the service. So every running process is associated with a user ID that owns that process. And by the way, I want to remind you of the distinction that a process is a running instance of an application. So there's an application on disk, like LS, many different people can run it. The user ID associated with the actual running version of LS is the one who typed LS at the command line. So there's a way to set the user ID that's associated with an application, and then the operating system will keep track of what that user ID is for every active process. And we're actually going to care about something called the effective user ID. So you can get UID, that's actually a system call. But there's also a get EUID, and we care about the effective UID for reasons that we'll talk about later. For now, let's just set that little detail aside, and we'll talk about UIDs more generally. So the OS thinks about user IDs as a number. It doesn't actually care what the name is that's associated with the account. But every user ID has a number every user name has a number. So when I log in, then all of the processes that I run are associated with my user ID number. And if I ever need to know what user name is associated with that number, the OS provides a utility that can go look in a file and map that number to a username. So I just talked about this. On standalone systems, it's in a file called /etc/password. That doesn't have plain text passwords, don't worry. But on most network systems, it'll be in some database that's accessible to all the servers in that system. There's also something called groups. So Unix and Windows both have the notion of groups that might have higher privileges than some other random users. And so I might also care about the group ID, in particular for that example of the file that I mentioned, where I want my group members to have read-only access, while I have, in addition, the ability to write to the file. And let's say I don't want anybody outside of my group to be able to see the file at all. So Unix has this notion of these three different groups baked into a lot of its structure in terms of permissions on processes and in terms of permissions on accessing files. And so we can get the effective group ID, same way. And note here again this notion of effective. And a user might be associated with more than one group, right? So I'm in the group for my research group, I'm in the faculty group, and so on and so forth. So there's a way to get the list of different group IDs that are associated and figure out which one is effective at the moment for the task that's being done. And just like user IDs, even though groups have names, the kernel only cares about the number. The number is the real ID. The name is just sort of syntactic convenience for humans to be able to refer to groups in a sensible way. It's not going to mean anything if we refer to my research group as group 23. How's anybody going to remember a bunch of random numbers? But it's easy to remember what the name is. You can see what your associated IDs are by logging into the server and just typing the command ID. This happens to be Professor Rice, but he's in group 21, faculty. His user ID is that long number, and he's in a couple of other groups as well, and presumably one for 3130 as well. So there are also a few groups that don't correspond to users. So weirdly, there's a special group that lists all the users that have access to display on a screen. So if you're logged into a specific machine, you'll get added to that group to display on that machine's, if you're actually logged directly into the machine, not SSH'd, if you've gone up and walked up to the machine and logged into it, you'll be in that machine's video group while you're logged in. And then you'll be removed from that group when you log out. If you SSH into that machine, you're not added to that display because presumably you're displaying on whatever system like your laptop that you SSH'd from. This is actually a bit of a kind of non-ideal implementation in Linux because in earlier versions of Unix because it means that when you log out from that machine, if you were in the video group and you leave any processes running, and there's a certain way that you can make a process stay running even when you log out called NoHub, those processes still have access to the monitor even after you've left the scene. Okay, so the heart of what I want to talk about is permissions. So POSIX has this very narrow view of what categories of users people care about when setting permissions for a file. So there's one owner, there's one group, and there's everybody else. You can't have a file be associated with multiple groups, You can't have a file be associated with multiple owners. And for the most part, that's perfectly okay. And there's a way around that with something called access control lists. But first, let's talk about the basic file permissions. And I know for some of you, this is review. You've worked with this before, but it's good to make sure that everybody's familiar with it. And there are only three categories of permissions: read, write, and execute. Now, in the case of a directory, which is really just another file on the disk, execute means that you can search the directory. So you can do ls on the directory, and you can cd into it. So the default, if you haven't set up a mask or if the system administrator hasn't changed the default permissions, is that every group gets read, write, execute on everything. Of course, that's typically not what you want, so this is always changed to be something else. I believe the default on our CS servers is that the owner gets read, write for executables, gets read, write, execute, and nothing for groups or the rest of the world. So let's make this a little more concrete. We talk about permissions in the categories. So we'll always talk about permissions as user, group, and then other. And the permissions are read, write, execute. And we can use the text symbols for this, or we can represent them as numbers. So read is 4, write is 2, execute is 1. And we can compose these. So if I want, for example, to set that file that I keep talking about to be read, write for me, read only for my group, and nothing for everybody else, I can say Chmod .txt. So this is the owner, this is the group, and this is other. And I give myself read and write permission. So 4 plus 2 is 6. I give my group only read permission, so I only put a 4 there. And then for everybody else, 0 means no permission. So I've now just set the permissions for this file the way I described. A couple of other examples here. Let's say I want the user to have read, write, and execute, and nobody else can do anything. So read is 4, write is 2, execute is 1, so that's 7. Or suppose I want the user to have read only, but the group to have read and execute, not sure why, just a made up example, and the rest of the world only execute. So read only is 4, read plus execute is 4 plus 1 is 5, and execute only is 1. Now some people like to use the numbers because it makes for less typing if you have these numbers in your head, and if you use them enough, you memorize them very quickly. There is a text way to write this too. We'll get to that in a sec. But any questions so far? So the key takeaways here, yeah, question.
If things belong to multiple groups, how do you specify which group you're referring to?
So every file will be created with a single group that it's associated with. And a file can only be associated with one group. So when you refer to the group permissions, the group permissions refer to that group that the file is associated with. You can change the group. The owner and the root, the system administrator, can change the group with a command called chgroup. So let's say I create a file and my default group is CS faculty, and I want to change that to be the group for that file to belong to my research group. So I could say chgroup Lava Lab is my research group name in the system, and I own the file, so I'm the one that's allowed to change the group. You, even if you're in my research group, you can't do that. So the key takeaways here, one owner, one group, and then everybody else. And the shorthand for those in the text examples we'll see in a minute are U for the user who owns it, the file, G for the group, and O for other. And we have read, write, and execute permissions. And so every permission will have three digits. There's actually a fourth digit that we're going to talk about later, but normally you just specify three digits like these examples here. And when you do LS, I have space here, so I'll put it down here. But by default, when you do LS, you don't see all the permissions details. If you want to see the permissions details, you do LS minus A. That'll incidentally show any files that start with dot as well. But then you'll see the permissions and the owner and the group. And you'll see the names, not the numbers. So I said there's letters that you can use instead of numbers. I personally prefer numbers. I find it easier to remember. I find it easier to read. But, you know, you should actually be able to do both. So the equivalent of chmod 700 is chmod u equals rwx, comma, og equals nothing, and then the file name. And so that will set the permissions to give the user read, write, execute access, or 7, and the group in the other, you could say GO just as easily, doesn't matter what the order is, will get nothing. Similarly, for the other example, chmod 451, we would say chmod U equals R, G equals RX, O equals X. Right? Those are equivalent. And you should be able to read it both ways. Basically, once you know the numbers, once you know the letters, it becomes pretty straightforward after a few times. Any questions on this? Yeah.
Can you explain again why O equals X is no execute?
So here, we're saying that we want the owner, the other, O, to have only execute permission. So this is always user, the person who owns the file. It's confusing that we call that U, not O. Group and other. And other is getting execute permission here. So if we scroll back here.
Because it says no execute on the last line.
Typo. Thanks for catching that. Sorry, I didn't even see the typo. Good example of seeing what we expect to see, not what's actually on the page. So for my example of chmod 640, what would the text equivalent of that be? Anybody want to volunteer an example? Yeah.
The user would have read and write access, and the groups would only have write back, or writing access.
Look good?
Yeah. From the groups of writing access. Or no, read access.
Yep. Everybody comfortable with that? Yes. Here. So four is read access, write is two access. Write access is two. And so what I wanted is that my group members can read the file but not write it. So that's why I wrote 640.
I got it, okay.
Any other questions? So instead of setting, I can add permissions with plus. So equals is set plus minus is remove. So let's say I want to add read and execute permissions for myself. I can say u plus rx. And nothing else changes. So whatever the permissions mask was before, I've just added read and execute. So if that means, for example, if the file previously had no user access, now it has read and execute access. If the file previously had write-only access, now it has read, write, and execute access, because I've just added these permissions. So it takes that mask and adds stuff to it. And one of the nice things about this formulation here is that the adding and subtracting works exactly the way you would want. So if I had write-only permission and the value in that field was 2, and now I want to add read and execute permission, I add 5. So 5 plus 2 is 7, and now I have read, write, and execute permission. Now let's say I want to subtract write permission. I could say chmod and say minus w, and that would be the same as subtracting 2, and what I would end up with is 5, which is read and execute, but no write permission. And so we have a couple examples of this here. Yes?
If I had like read and I subtracted 2, would that change it to read?
That's not valid. It would have no effect, basically. So chmod is smart enough to realize that if you have read-only and you subtract, so you only do the subtraction using this text format. So if you have read-only and you subtract write access, it's just, nothing's going to change. So with the numerical representation, you can't just say, I want to subtract 2. You have to specify the actual numbers. Any other questions on this? If not, I want to get to access control lists. So we've talked a little bit about some of the shortcomings of this default way of specifying permissions. So let me just make an aside and say that what we just saw with one user, one group, and everybody else, and giving permissions for each of these is kind of like a stubby version of an access control list. So the definition in CS of an access control list is a list of people who are allowed to access a resource and what their permissions are. You could list everybody in the entire department one after another on an access control list and what their permissions are, but in most cases, that shortened version of one user, one group, and everybody else describes exactly what people want. However, there are cases where it's not sufficient, and we want to get into more detail. Maybe there are two different groups of users who need access to a file. Or maybe there's one special person for some reason who I also want to give write access to a file. And so what Unix versions do, what the POSIX standard, which is a standard that all Unix-like systems adhere to, specifies, and Windows NT FS file system also does this, has essentially the same thing, is allow you to specify on a user granularity what their permissions are. And here are some examples of what an access control list might contain. So these are examples of ACL contents. So the ACL might say that for a given file, that the group of students has read and execute permissions, or that the group of faculty has read, write, and execute permissions, or that user MST3K has read, write, execute, while user TJ1A has no permissions at all. And so there's no need to add stuff to the ACL if the default user group owner permissions are sufficient, but this can allow you to add extra details. Question. If somebody is both the user, i.e. the owner of the file, and member of a group that pertains to that file, the user permissions will always take precedence. So often users have higher permissions than anybody else. There was a silly example, just for illustrative purposes, where that wasn't the case when we said 451, but usually users have higher permissions if they're not at least equal, and so users should take precedence over group, or weird things happen, where you own a file, but you have lower permission than your group, and that's not typically what was intended. So here are some commands for manipulating access control lists. Get facul will, for a file, will just list what the current ACL looks like. Set facul will add a line to the ACL. So set facul dash M is saying modify, and it'll say that this user has no permissions for this file. I can also remove a line, so I could remove TJ1A from the access control list altogether. And then I can add something to the ACL, but maybe I have a whole bunch of users that I'm adding permission for, and I don't want to have to type all that out. So capital M here, as opposed to lowercase m, means that I'm going to read what to add from a file. So what this is saying is I'm going to add stuff to the access control list, and the set of entries to add is contained in this file. And similarly with capital X. And any other questions? So before I get to the next chunk of material, I just want to pause and say that my recommendation is only use access control lists when you need to add a permission that doesn't fit neatly into the user group other category. So maybe there's somebody outside the group that you can't add to your group for some reason who needs permission. Good use for an ACL. But ACLs, it's easy to forget about what's in there. And so just use the simple chmod when that is sufficient. So how does this actually get checked? So when we make a system call, like opening a file, the handler for that system call will actually check whether the user's effective, the process that's making the open system call, whether the effective user ID for that process has permission for that file. So it takes that user ID and matches it against the permissions, whether they're set with chmod or an access control list. And this is anything that manipulates files will be handled this way. The system call, whether it's open or rename or delete or anything else, will check the effective user ID of the process that's making the system call against the permissions that are recorded on that file. and only the owner can change the permissions on the file. There are also applications that you might want to run that have restricted permissions. So for example, kill is an application that I can run from the command line that will kill a specified process. So let's say I have a process running in the background and it seems to be hung. I don't know why, I just want to make it stop running and stop wasting CPU cycles. I can say kill process ID, and that will kill the process. And if it's my own process, obviously I should be able to do that. If it's your process, probably you don't want me to just arbitrarily be able to kill any process that anybody's running. Super user, the system administrator, is a different story, but the average user shouldn't be allowed to do that. And so kill will make sure that the effective user ID who's invoking kill matches the effective user ID of the process that's being killed. Seems intuitive, right? Any questions? So I keep talking about this super user. And what is that exactly? So every operating system has a notion of an administrator who has elevated privileges. In Unix land, that is user ID 0. And we refer to them as super user or root. Those terms are interchangeable. On other non-Unix systems, they're typically called administrator, etc. There's some system functionality that can only run with user ID 0. And it typically passes all permission checks. There's kind of a special case in permission checking. So root can go in and change the permission or the owner or the group of any file by design. So you need to trust your system administrator, of course. But there are functions like shutting down the system that only the system administrator should be able to use. So let's differentiate between this very powerful notion of the kernel, the core part of the OS that's running with privileged mode, and the super user, who is this person who has special rights. So kernel mode, the core part of the operating system, is invoked by a system call or certain other events that might cause the core operating system to run. And the way that the system knows that the kernel has elevated privileges is that all of these ways of invoking the core part of the OS cause the hardware to actually set a bit that indicates that the hardware is now running in privileged mode. So that syscall instruction to invoke a system call sets that bit. And then the handler runs with elevated privileges. And if the handler decides that this system call is invalid or the user's not allowed to run it, it will either kill the process or return an error and go back into regular user mode. If some external event, like a network or I/O event or something else that interrupts the system, causes the operating system to be invoked, again, that external hardware event that invokes the OS to handle it will start by setting this privileged bit before the OS starts running. And as soon as the OS is done with its operating system work, it will reset that bit back to user mode. Whereas the super user is just a user that has certain extra privileges. So you can think of the super user analogy to the OS as having higher privileges as being like the kernel mode having higher privileges on the hardware. So kernel can actually execute certain hardware assembly instructions that regular user programs can't. And so that's probably a good stopping place. On Thursday, we'll pick up with what happens when you actually log into a machine.